and Vecchi said, "Our main task as teachers is to create situations within which creative processes can be experimented with, grow, and evolve. This means devising and implementing generative contexts, paying attention to procedures, and creating the right conditions to make possible the fruition of the creative process that we aim to sustain and stimulate." My guests joining me today have embodied these words. Their stories of the creation of generative contexts will help us all become awakened to Reggio. Those of us who have been studying the Reggio approach in the United States have been so inspired by the work of Opal School, which both my guests today had a part in moving forward. Susan Harris McKay was the pedagogical director of Opal School and Portland Children's Museum, and is the author of Story Workshop, New Possibilities for Young Writers. This book is based on her experiences, developing a way of empowering young children to make their voices heard and their thinking visible through the 100 languages. Susan's work has inspired thousands of teachers to expand their use of play, the arts, and inquiry to support children's right to high-quality educational environments. Matt Carlson was the director of professional development for Opal School and Portland Children's Museum. For 15 years prior to joining Opal School and the Center for Learning, Matt worked in a range of roles in various educational settings. As he developed a relationship with Opal School as a parent and collaborator, he saw the important role it played in expanding an educator's vision of what he describes as third doors that adults and children might walk through together to create richer, more just worlds. Matt and Susan have now created the Center for Playful Inquiry, where they accompany and embolden educators on their paths towards transformation. Welcome, Matt and Susan. I'm so excited to have you with me today.
Thanks for having us.
I always like to start from this place of asking my guests, what is your connection to the Reggio approach? And I'll sort of add on, what is the connection that Opal School had to the Reggio approach?
That is a long story.
It always is.
Yeah, I suppose that's true. I became aware of the Reggio approach when it was probably my third or fourth year of teaching kindergarten and first grade, moving to a new school district. I was going to teach a kindergarten and first grade alongside another teacher who I didn't know. So I learned that she had just returned from a study tour in Reggio. And I don't remember where I had picked up information about the approach exactly, but I did know enough that I was excited that she had just been there and was really curious about what she was going to do. And I noticed, of course, the environment that she was starting to put together in this new place. It was a whole new program in this school, but it turned out that she had been actually on the same study tour as Judy Graves, who was the founder of Opal School. And I didn't know Judy at the time. It was really several years later that these connections were made as Opal School was starting to be developed. When I found out that this connection existed, I was just so, it was really out of character. I just sort of went after this connection and wanted to be involved and asked if I could just sit and listen to meetings and do anything to help at all to get this school going. And Judy thought that I was kind of crazy, but kind of probably needed a lot of help. So she let me join in. Opal School was developed by this group of people who included this first teacher that I knew. You know, they had been to Reggio and they had seen this just incredible expressions that were, you know, that we all understand and recognize so clearly as the work of the children Reggio Emilia. You know, they just wondered, like so many of us do, why we don't see that same level of expressivity in children in the United States, oftentimes. for that group, it really became a question of the implications of that work and those observations on public elementary school. And so, you know, not only what did that have to do with sort of children in general, but what about a little bit older children and or what might be the relationship there? So that began the project. The mission of Opal School was always to provoke fresh ideas in other schools, right? It was never built to be this kind of tiny special experience for lucky children who happen to win the lottery and enroll, but always to be a place where we were trying to learn on behalf of other teachers elsewhere. So even before the school opened its doors, the school hosted its first summer symposium. And at that symposium, Louise Cadwell and Chuck Schwall from the college school came and they showed photographs of children in Reggio at work in those schools in Reggio. And those may have been the first photos I ever saw from Reggio. And I cried. And because there was just something about the way that children were being captured, the respect and the expectation for their capacity.
I think that all of us were impacted on some deep emotional level if we're really studying this approach in that way. Matt, do you want to tell us a little bit about your experience as well?
You know, my awareness of what the folks in Reggio were doing and of what implication that might have for teachers and children and families outside of Italy came through Susan and through Opal School. Susan and I had met each other through a teacher research project that was organized by Ruth Shigeri Hubbard and Jill Ostro at Lewis and Clark College that united a elementary school teacher, a high school teacher, and a kind of middle grades teacher. And they knew that they wanted to work with Susan, and they knew that they wanted to work with this great high school teacher. And they're like, we need a guy. We need somebody who's in the intermediate grades. I know someone. And I got to get roped into that. Luckily, met Susan at that time. Over time, I was able to engage with Opal School as a middle school teacher. My students, my class in middle school teamed with Susan's class in elementary school for a series of outdoor adventures over the course of the year. That was a teacher research project that culminated with one of my students joining Susan and me in presenting at a summer symposium about the work. And then ultimately, my daughter was able to attend Opal School. And I was watching it as I was working in a professional development for teachers. I had shifted from a classroom role to helping teachers think about their practice separately. And it was both recognizing the power of thinking that was coming out of these spaces, and then the quality of the spaces themselves, and the nature of the way in which these teachers were working with each other, the kind of questions they were asking, the kind of expectations they had for each other, and the image that they held of children in that work that was so profound. And then I ended up eventually finding my way to Opal School as an employee the same year that NERIA was hosted in Portland, in cooperation with Opal School. And that was like, that was a greatest hits NERIA moment. I mean, Tiziana Filippini was there, Vevecchi was there, Colina Rinaldo was there. It was like, it was quite a group of folks who were there. And that my first kind of formal meeting with and meeting the Italians. And over the years, that's become a really valuable and profound kind of conversation back and forth.
I really don't think I realized that the school was created thinking about what it could do beyond the walls of the school. And that is just so beautiful.
You know, when you say that it was created thinking about what could happen apart, you know, charter schools in this country are a hot political topic. And every state orients their charter schools in different ways and different aims. Opal School was a publicly funded charter school, and the purpose of charter schools in the state of Oregon was for that kind of innovation that might influence other places, pedagogical innovation that might influence other places. So I knew that wasn't the focus in lots of other places. It was the focus there, and so it wasn't incidental to the project.
So let's jump then into talking more about the Opal School and your, it sounds like, many years of really being a part of developing what this place was and collaborating with the people that were there and the dynamic aspect of how it moved forward in so many ways. Sadly, the Opal School is closed now, and I assume because of the pandemic. Yeah.
Right.
But I really do believe that this work will go on inspiring so many of us. Can you tell us about the school, about some of the big ideas that you and the educators there sort of studied over the years together, the things that were sort of what you would describe as the identity of the school?
You mentioned the Story Workshop book that now exists well beyond the school, hopefully for a long time to come.
Congratulations on that.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you. It came from a question, right, that was asked probably the second year that the school was in existence. Judy, as she did, you know, oftentimes when we came together, was just sort of give us permission to go research, go explore, go engage in learning about children and learning. So the question that she had asked was, you know, what's the relationship between literacy and the arts? And to turn to teachers and say, go figure, you know, who wants to figure that out, first of all? And is anybody interested? And, you know, I was thrilled with that question and just the invitation to go play. That was the kind of question that Judy traditionally brought forward, big questions central to the pedagogical approach, big questions that it were intended to, you know, provoke new practices that then led to new theories and, you know, just this ongoing cycle of observation, reflection, documentation, new questions. So to think about central questions, Opal School was guided by a set of principles and values with an emphasis on trying to learn more about the natural learning strategies of children, trying to continually expand our image of the child. And that alone was just this incredible unfolding project, as you know, every year, every one of us had a moment when we were able to expand that image further and further. There was a time, probably, I don't know, 6 or 7 years into the work, that we started to recognize that the children, especially the children who had been, I guess it must have been 6 or 7 years, because the school started as a preschool through first grade. And then we let the school grow up to fifth grade. There was a cohort of children that had really traveled the whole way. Even in those early years when we were all fumbling around in this messy process of trying to figure out what we wanted to do and understand it at the same time, they got ahead of us. You know, we started to recognize that the children knew things and were aware of things that we weren't. And that kind of reciprocity continued to carry us forward. And that relationship with the children and their families in concert with this professional development work that we were always doing, including the symposium. And then that, as that grew, because people got more interested, you know, that process of needing to find ways to talk about what we were learning and tell stories from the classroom really drove the work forward as much as anything else. I noticed in your introduction about Matt, you talked about this third door idea.
Yeah.
And that came from a child originally. And it's funny actually, because Matt's daughter was in this class I was teaching. It was fourth and fifth grade. We were doing this long project looking at, it was the year that Barack Obama was elected president, which was really, it really stirred the children. And so we embarked on this whole project of looking at United States history through various ways. But Matt came in as a volunteer. So he was there when we were having, it was towards the end of the year, the children were engaged in this big dialogue about the relationship between empathy and justice. And this one child, this eight-year-old who happened to be, he was the youngest in the class. He said something which came out in a really, really messy way, but he said something like, you know, it's like there's two doors. And if you open it in a hallway, and if you open one door, there's people in it. And if you open the door, they can be free. And if you open the other door, there's treasure, I think, or something like that. But the problem is you can only open one door. So what are you going to do? And he said, so the most empathetic thing to do would be to find a third door. And, you know, and I just remember having to decipher what he had actually said in listening to an audio tape of the conversation later on. And as I was unearthing this gem, just my mind just being completely blown, because I don't think I had ever considered this notion that, you know, there is always, always something else available to us that we may not yet be able to see. Wow. And he knew that, and he constructed that whole idea in that moment, and we've used it ever since. So that's where that little nugget comes from.
So beautiful. Wow.
I think when I think of that story of Paul that Susan was just sharing, it kind of reflects in keeping with your question about the tie to Reggio, it really emphasizes the power of play and poetic languages to help children express things about the world that children are, I don't know whether uniquely able to express, or at least are able to express, or are readily able to express in a way that schools oftentimes are not well set up to support them, and yet could be, right? Like there could be a decision towards that. I think about Judy on that trip to Reggio that led to the founding of Opal School. She asked Loris Malaguzzi, what do you think might be the implications of all this to older children? And at the time, the folks in Reggio were only working with children up through about age six. And of course, now they're working with older children. And he said, you know what, we don't know. We haven't explored that question yet, but we think that it likely has something to do with the role of the arts. When I think about stories from Opal School's experience, it's oftentimes the role of the arts that plays heavily in that. And I think about the difference between how I thought about the role of the arts in working with children in schools before I went to Opal School. There was a big role of the arts, but I think it had a lot to do with using the arts to reflect children's thinking. What I learned about through my work at Opal School was about the role of the arts in supporting the development of children's thinking, of sparking and catalyzing and sustaining children's thinking. And when I think about that, I oftentimes think about this young boy named Bodhi. We were sitting in a circle and about to turn to the arts to explore a concept. And as so often happens in a fourth and fifth grade circle before you transition to the next thing, the teacher in the circle said, all right, everybody, do you know what you're going to do next? And Bodhi said, no, I have no idea what I'm going to do next. And I can't wait for the arts to tell me. You know, like there were materials that were waiting for him, and he had developed such a confidence that he didn't have to know what he was going to do with a paintbrush and with India ink or with clay or with wire, that just doing that, putting his hands on something, was going to lead to some interesting spots. And that felt big to me.
This leads us right to the book that Susan has authored about Story Workshop. I know that for years in my school, we would watch the videos online about Story Workshop. The teachers who I worked with, we all are sitting here just so excited about this connection, as I'm hoping that you'll be able to tell us a little bit more. Help us find some entry points for, with your book, with the idea of Story Workshop, and I think from what Matt said, the idea that it's not just about the arts expressing children's thinking, but really moving children forward into higher levels of thinking and learning.
Yeah, I mean, it's about the dialogue, right? Whether it's with people or with materials. And it's about the opportunity to see what you've said, to see the extent to which what you've said comes back to you in a way that you expected it to. And whether that's with materials or with other people, it kind of works in the same way. This work was a fully collaborative process with really everyone at Opal School. Over time, you know, as we began the work that first year after Judy asked that question, and it was really interesting. It was interesting what was happening, and we were having all of these, I think, fairly predictable struggles that I think people continue to have. Is just, you know, we're trying to teach children how to write here. We need them to become writers. They're working with clay and paint and. Like, how do you balance that? And how do you shift your expectations? And I think the one piece that we didn't really talk much about initially was the role of play, how central that was to creating the relationship between the arts and the literacy piece, or getting to see how clearly that when children have some materials in front of them, anything, you know, they'll play with it. And when they play, they, with their hands, their minds are on something and they have a story to tell. I mean, it's just what we do as human beings. And when children have adults who can come up alongside them and say, tell me your story. And they start to understand that what they're doing in play, the talk or the ideas that they have are what every other human being and author and storyteller that came before them did, right? That's what we do together as humans. And that's how we connect. And that's how we find belonging. And again, you know, see if what we say or what we think makes sense to other people and learn more about it when it comes back to us. And so entry points, I think, are not really complicated in a lot of ways. I mean, the complexity, the complicated part might be in just finding some time or some space, right? But children will go there. There's nothing that will stop them because it's just a natural strategy to play and tell stories and be together and connect with things, and, you know, materials will give them ideas. So I think there's just, like, it's easy to get that started. And then I think what teachers grapple with is just how to, in some ways, I think, legitimize that kind of play and what looks like just children doing what children do, and making that, you know, legitimizing that in the culture or in the context of school. And it's in all of that that new possibilities might start to arise, if we can stay focused on those tremendous capacities that children have, and trusting that the experiences that they've had and the ideas that they have, the perspectives that they've developed over time, like, that is what belongs in school. These are just means to bring it in.
This is a huge shift, I think, for people and thinking about the role of the teacher. And what really struck me about this work was how the teacher's presence drove their creation of this kind of environment. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about what a teacher's presence could look like in a setting that is thinking about story workshop?
Oftentimes, teachers start with an imagination that there are two possibilities of their role. And one possibility is that they're sitting right at the center and that they're directing everything. They're the ones who are making the decisions in the classroom and that they're just trying to figure out how to get the children to go along with those decisions, which is would of course be a remarkable feat. Like that would be something. It might not be what we're aiming for, but if they could do that, then that would be something. And then the other possibility is that they're completely aloof from everything happening in the classroom, that they're standing apart from it and just witnessing what children are doing. And like Paul said, that there needs to be a third door, right? There needs to be something other than that. And again, the folks in Reggio have spent so much time articulating what it means to be fully present to a part of, in solidarity with a community of children and to be growing alongside there. When I think about that in relationship to Story Workshop Studio, I mean, to Story Workshop, excuse me. Susan and I have been participating in conversations with this group of educators across North America, all around the world, through this project that we've got called Story Workshop Studio. And we were having a conversation with this teacher in Germany not so long ago. And she said, you know, when I came to it, when I first heard about Story Workshop, I thought that it was just loose parts collage. Mm-hmm. I thought that really it was just that's what it was, is collage. And since I've been participating in these conversations and read Susan's book, I realized that it has more to do with your idea of who children are and what your relationship with children are and what children's roles might be in a larger civic society and how school can reflect that and what that has to do with democracy and justice. I think in order to get there, you got to start somewhere, and maybe it really is with loose parts collage. Maybe it really is just getting your hands into something and then realizing, oh, what happens when I tinker with this a little bit? Okay. If I use a different quality of materials with the children, a different kinds of the arts, if I combine different pieces with each other, if I talk to children about what do they experience when they use this material versus a different material? How did their formulation and composition of a story come about when they were using clay? And how might it come about differently when they're using blocks or using crepar, whatever that is? And what happens when I change the questions that I'm asking children and respond differently to what children are bringing forward? I think that involves the teacher in a different relationship with the learning, involves the children in a different relationship with the learning and each other and the teacher in a way that shifts the roles of everybody, including the role of the teacher.
I keep hearing you talking about the idea of the teacher as researcher here, always asking questions, looking at what they're doing and deconstructing it and really trying to understand it in new ways, which I think is such an entry point, a shift for so many of us. I keep hearing you talking about the idea of the teacher as researcher here, always asking questions, looking at what they're doing and deconstructing it and really trying to understand it in new ways, which I think is such an entry point, a shift for so many of us. I just wanted to end with a question that I think those of us who are working with educators around the country are feeling what it feels like nowadays, that it's sometimes challenging in this time. I want to know if you can give us some kind of inspiration, something that would, that keeps you motivated.
Listen to the children. They have so much wisdom to share. And if we can do that, if we can listen to what the children have to say and share about everything they have learned and experienced over the last 24 months, they've learned a lot, like really important things. They've noticed a lot of things. They've been in relationships in ways that we haven't had opportunities to hear their perspectives on before. Children are coming to us in ways that they haven't ever before. And that should be an opportunity for so much shift if we let it be. I don't work with a single teacher, Matt, and I never hear from teachers that we want everything to go back the way it was, right? That it's always this motivation to not go back to normal, to build something new together. And we have to rely on the children to help us do that, because it's the only way that we're going to be able to see in new ways, right? It's one thing to say, I don't ever want to go back to normal. It's another thing entirely to invent something different. Recognizing that it's complicated to move into spaces that we've never yet seen. So where do we reach for support and for help? What kinds of questions can we ask each other? And how can we lean on each other as adults in order to listen better to what the children have to offer us? They see things that we forgot how to see. And so if we can really be at work in solidarity with them, we should be able to, you know, invent something new together. What would you say, Matt?
When I hear your question, especially when I try and relate it within this context of this question of what might Reggio offer us in this moment, I think that you were in part foregrounding the pandemic experience. We're also living the experience of climate catastrophe. We're also living an experience of increased awareness of and commitment to our participation in anti-fascist and anti-racist deconstruction, reconstruction, new building. That's where Reggio grew. You know, it grew out of these ashes of the impact of fascism, the impact of World War II. That can inspire us to listen to children, but it can also inspire us to listen to each other as we listen to children. And I think that turning to the wisdom of children and the wisdom of people who are wise enough to attend to the wisdom of children can really push us to create something that this moment is really calling for. And it can't be done without turning to each other.
I can't thank you both enough for speaking with me, with my listeners today, for all that you've done for our field. I am thinking so much about Bodhi. And I'm thinking about this idea of being excited about what we don't know and really looking to be uncomfortable, having that disequilibrium that will help us move forward in new ways and all the ways that you just described. So thank you both so much. I hope that we meet again in the future.
Thanks for inviting us to be uncomfortable with you. Thank you.
If you would like to know more about my wonderful guests or the Reggio Approach, please go to my website at sandylanesconsulting.com or find us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter.